It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have you ever wondered who invented the wheel? Who told the first joke? Who drank the first beer? Who was the first surgeon? Who sparked the first fire? Well, if you have, you're in good company with my guest this hour, science writer Cody Cassidy. You may remember his book from a couple years back. He co-authored the book titled And Then You're Dead: What Really Happens If You Get Swallowed by a Whale, Are Shot from a Cannon, or Go Barreling Over Niagara. His latest book is titled Who Ate the First Oyster? The Extraordinary People Behind the Greatest Firsts in History. And in it, he sets out to find out about, well, not just humankind's ancient firsts, but about the people who actually accomplished them. For the book, Cody Cassidy interviewed more than 100 experts. He read dozens of books and hundreds of research papers. Cody Cassidy joins me now from San Francisco. Welcome to our program, Cody.
Thanks for having me.
I love this book. So inventive, an inventive, innovative way to approach history. Before we get into some of these stories, and they are captivating, and we really learn a lot from them, the way you approached it. Explain a little bit more of the approach you took to these stories, the history you tell in this book, and how you got the idea.
I got the idea because I was sort of interested in firsts, just as a category, and then I read this really interesting tidbit on sort of the prehistoric first, the first person to suffer cancer. There's an ancient Egyptian tablet that describes this person, and it turns out it was breast cancer. And I became interested in the details that brought this ancient individual to life, this prehistoric person. I think we often, when we're thinking about prehistory, we don't think about people, we think about peoples. So I thought I could combine those two and talk about specific individuals from prehistory who were the first person to do something. And if I brought them to life by talking about who they were and what their motivations might have been, I thought I could make these questions sort of both personal and interesting.
Right. Bring them to life. I like that phrase because that's exactly the feeling I had in reading your book. And if I can read a short passage out of your introduction as a way of explaining what you're doing here, you write, "In the end, I identified 17 ancient individuals who lived before or without writing. These are people who scholars know existed and whose extraordinary or fateful acts are the foundation of modern life. Then I asked everyone from archaeologists to engineers, geneticists to lawyers, astrologists to brewmasters, who these anonymous individuals might have been, what they were thinking, where they were born, what they spoke, if they spoke, what they wore, what they believed, where they lived, how they died, how they made their discovery, and most important, why it mattered." Well, let's start off the way you do in the book, because this is really a tale, and I remember this when this first entered the news in the early 1990s. Let's start with who was the murderer in the first murder mystery. For this has to do with who's called the Iceman. Do you pronounce his name Otzi?
It's Otzi.
Otzi. Okay. So you did your own investigation in 2017 of this Otzi, this Iceman, a man found in 1991, frozen at an altitude of over 1,000 feet in the Alps. Tell us what you did to investigate this and how you came to the conclusion, based on expert interviews, that it was a murder.
Violence has, of course, unfortunately, been with our species since the beginning. But the really fascinating thing about Otzi is that it really appears as if someone murdered him and attempted to get away with it. Otzi was found in on the top of the Italian Alps, right along the border with Austria. And it so happens that right after he died, a glacier slid over him and perfectly preserved his body. It's almost as if he's been sitting in a morgue for over 5,000 years. And when he was discovered, perhaps the most interesting thing that they found was this arrowhead buried into his back. It had cut the artery that feeds his right arm, which if it's severed, bleed out in a few minutes. So it's there's no question that he was killed, and that's not terribly unique. A lot of ancient bodies are found that died from violence, but there are a few unique aspects of his death. And I actually did. I climbed these Italian Alps. They're incredibly steep. He died at almost 10,000 feet, which partly explains why he was so well preserved. But the person who killed him, who was someone I named Giuvoli for the purposes of this book, based on where I think he was from, probably shot him from about 100 feet away, which is with the prehistoric equipment he was using, is actually a really remarkable distance. But he left. After he shot Uzi, he removed the arrow shaft from Uzi's body because they found 14 arrows at the scene, but they were all Uzi's arrows. They weren't the killing arrow. And he also left the copper axe. And this is sort of like leaving the a Rolex at the scene of a crime. It was incredibly valuable then. So when he removed it, he must have been very interested in. It would have identified him as the killer when he returned home, is the theory.
Mm-hmm. And who did you talk to about this to reach these conclusions?
Well, actually, they hired the museum there. There's an entire museum in the town of Bolzano, Italy, that has dedicated itself to Uzi. And they hired a modern homicide detective to actually investigate this case a few years ago. One of the funny quotes is that when he looked at the body, he actually he said there's more evidence at this scene than there are in many modern crimes. Uzi is probably the most studied corpse in human history. They know so many things about him. They've looked at the pollen in his stomach and looked at the layers in his digestive system of pollen and been able to determine the path he took. On his final walk, which is the path that I tried to retrace.
And it's funny, in your book, you were very close to the site and had to turn back for fear of your life?
Well, yes. It turns out Uzi was a better meteorologist than I, because I as I got close to the top, there was quite a bit more snow than I expected, and it was very incredibly foggy. I could only see about 30 or 40 feet, and I really hadn't seen anybody all day. But right when I was about less than a quarter mile from the top, you have to walk along the ridge to get to his site. There was a few other climbers who I think they were Austrian, and they didn't speak English, but they had huge crampons and ice axes, and that was concerning right from the get go. And then
you had tennis shoes on, or just
and I had tennis
boots.
Shoes. Yes.
Oh.
And then we didn't share very much language in common, but they quickly made it clear to me that I probably shouldn't go on. So I took their advice and decided against joining Uzi out there in the ice and retreated home.
Okay, investigating the probable murder of Uzi, the Iceman killed over 5,000 years ago in the Italian Alps. So we do go back much further in history with your book, and let's do that now. And a short aside here, because I really like what you did. You point out, and I've always, you know, whether it's evolution or whatever it is, we don't really have the capacity to conceptualize time in the length of times that we're talking about here. So each chapter, each story of these ancient firsts, tell us how you make that real to us in terms of how close these are to us in time, or how distant they are in the past.
Yeah, it's really difficult. When you're talking about the first person I profile here, lived nearly 3 million years ago, which is a number of years that I don't think that really anybody is capable of grasping how long ago that was. So really, what I tried to do was describe who they were, and what they looked like. I mean, this person who lived 3 million years ago was sort of was called an Australopithecine, and she was covered in fur. She walked upright. So she was sort of halfway between a chimpanzee and a human. If you saw her, I think that would be your takeaway. But yeah, I think it is a real problem. I don't think that even the experts can really grasp quite how long 3 million years ago, or even 10,000 years, for example. I mean, that is twice as long as all of written history. So it is. I really tried to accomplish or try to overcome that by describing who the people were, and hopefully that conveys quite how long ago it was.
It certainly does. So let's go back to that earliest incident that you reconstruct with the help of experts over 3 million years ago. A different species. You have a couple of stories that have to do with, human hominids who coexisted with Homo sapiens or existed before Homo sapiens on our Earth. This one, Australopithecus, and you named her Ma, and she invented a baby sling. Tell us a little bit about that story.
Yeah, I think this, at least archaeologically speaking, is the oldest invention. It, but before this was, she lived, as I said, 3 million years ago, and this is long before Homo sapiens evolved. We evolved probably around 200,000 years ago. So, but she is an ancestor of ours, and long before her, our ancestors have been chipping rocks to make sharp cutting tools, and these are some of the oldest tools. But the baby sling, she was a young mother and had an age old problem. That she had to carry her baby, and she. This is just right after we began to walk upright, and this is when a lot of archaeologists have determined that it simply was too difficult for her to carry her baby for what would have amounted to about 3 months before it was strong enough to hold on and gather food, and that we therefore must have come up with an invention to solve this problem. And so simply by tying, if Ma had simply tied it overhand knot with a strip of fine or leather and to her baby and held her baby to her, she would have made it easier to gather food. But this actually solves an enormous problem with humans. It's called the smart bipedal paradox, which is that we have large heads, and we have, because we walk upright, we have narrow birth canals. And so by having this baby sling, she enabled us to be born prematurely, basically, which is why human babies take so long, over a year, before they can walk or even hold on. And that would seem to be, evolutionarily speaking, a very dangerous period of time. But because mothers had baby slings, thanks to Ma, it sort of solved this problem. Now we can have big heads and walk upright. Mm-hmm.
And just to be clear, so our listeners know this, you call her Ma. I mean, this is to whatever extent, and the further you go back in history or the less evidence you have, these are fictional people. You give them names. Of course, we don't really know what the name of that person was. But what you're saying here, when you recreate, to the best of our knowledge, a certain person, that this is the best we can do in describing who this person was based on the expertise of scientists?
Exactly, and it's a person who existed, we don't know their name, and it seems like a trivial detail, but I feel like a name is important for identifying an individual. I think it sort of grounds us. So yes, for everybody who in the book, who has lived in prehistory before writing, I gave them a name simply to something to refer them to as throughout the book, and also to drive home that these were individuals.
These were real people, or people, not necessarily Homo sapiens either. So let's talk about that other huge discovery for humankind. We'll jump forward, over a million years. To talk about who discovered fire 1.9 million years ago, you write in the book. Now, this is before humans evolved, and this chapter, as you write, is fascinating because it involves our ancestors as Homo sapiens, the Homo erectus and Homo habilis. You write, Charles Darwin called the mastery of fire the single greatest discovery in the history of our species, excepting language. If anything, that's an underestimation. Fire wasn't controlled by our species. It's responsible for it. Fire didn't simply make life easier. It forged us, principally and most dramatically through cooking. Explain your investigation here.
Yes. So this is someone who I've again named Martine. She was living 1.9 million years ago. And archaeologists know this because of the dramatic changes that fire made to our very skeleton. It because of cooking, it basically doubles the amount of calories. When you cook a meal, it doubles the amount of calories you can get from that meal, which dramatically reduced our intestines. It made our jaws weaker because food is easier to chew. And this all shows up in the archaeological record around the 1.9 million years ago, when there's a dramatic shift from Homo habilis, which are pretty chimpanzee-looking, and Homo erectus, which are 6 feet tall. They are very human-looking, and they don't have fur, for example. And this Martine, who lived 1.9 million years ago, I think was probably chipping stones, like we've been doing for millions of years, except you don't. A lot of people think that when you chip regular stones, you might spark a fire, but that's not true. You need a particular kind of stone. It's called a pyrite. It's filled with iron. And so if she'd accidentally grabbed a piece of pyrite and chipped her flint tool, she would have knocked off unexposed iron, which when it hits oxygen, burns bright enough and hot enough to start a fire. And she probably wasn't the first person to do this. We'd been chipping stones for millions of years, but she might have been the first person to understand why it happened. And this is sort of the greatest geologic observation in our evolutionary history, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Right. And one point here, I love not only the way you humanize, make these people real in ancient history, but the humor you bring in here. I was laughing out loud several times reading it. So at the end of this chapter, when you talk about Martine, the discoverer of fire, 1.9 million years ago, here's the way that chapter ends. Upon her death, you would think, you would like to think that her community honored this hominin for her discovery. Perhaps fittingly, she could have been cremated. Unfortunately, Homo habilis didn't honor their dead, so the only ceremony her companions would have likely bestowed upon the body of this great hominin who ever lived would have been to haul it away so it didn't attract scavengers to the campfire.
Yes, it's unfortunate that, but probably true that we weren't practicing funerals. Martine is probably the greatest hominin to have ever lived. She was probably not honored in any way.
Okay. If you've just joined us, my guest is science writer Cody Cassidy. His latest book, Who Ate the First Oyster? The Extraordinary People Behind the Greatest Firsts in History. He recounts 17 ancient individuals. These are people who lived before or without writing. And people who, according to Cassidy's research, scholars know existed. We have about 5 minutes before we need to take a break here. Let's go right after that. Let's go right to that tale that is, put the title with, Who Ate the First Oyster? And this happens when humans start eating things out of the ocean or water.
Yeah, this question sort of seems like a joke, but the weird part about it is it actually has an answer. Archaeologists recently discovered the oldest eaten shellfish. They were found in a cave in South Africa, and they're around 164,000 years old. And the first person to eat an oyster, I've named Oyster Gal. She not only had a bold palate, she actually there are so many oysters in this cave and shellfish that she must have made a really remarkable scientific discovery that allowed her to gather them, because she didn't actually live along the water. This is before humans had boats or fishing gear or really any way to gather food from the sea, so they didn't live along the ocean. Which brings, when gathering oysters, brings up the problem of the tides, because oysters spend 90% of the time underwater. But the archaeologist I spoke to thinks that to gather so many, the oyster gal, she must have been able to predict the tides, which is, fortunately for her, advertised, of course, by the moon. When the moon and the sun are aligned, it creates super low tides. And you can see this with either a full or new moon. So she not only possessed a really bold and daring taste, she was really kind of a remarkable scientist as well.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about how this would have affected sort of the tribe, the makeup of these families that would have existed in this time. You said, in order to cook, females were forced into a kind of mafia-like protection racket with larger males who ensured a smaller female could cook in exchange for some of the food, right? So you really get an insight to, well, I guess things that even are traced right till today in some cases.
Yeah, that's a theory that tries to explain the sort of curious gender divide that's seen in basically every hunter-gatherer community, which is that the women generally do more cooking and the men generally gather food that sort of, or hunt food that sort of runs, flies, or swims away, and the women generally gather staples. And there's still a lot of mystery as to why that's so consistent, but one theory I liked a lot was that one. Was that perhaps it is explained by fire, because as one can imagine, cooking your food, you have to leave it over the fire for 20 or 30 minutes, which shouldn't be possible. If you look at how chimpanzees react around food, they eat it as fast as possible, or somebody's going to steal it. And so this theory tries to explain how we were able to be so cooperative around food.
Mm-hmm. Which of these stories, we have about a minute before the break, which of these stories is your favorite? There's 17 of them that you recount here.
I like the who drank the first beer. Not because I thought it was going to be sort of a silly yuck answer, and it turns out the first person to drink beer was actually really changed quite a lot, because archaeologists now think that this person who I call Osiris, who lived 16,000 years ago, was one of the first people to gather wheat. And archaeologists now think that instead of bread, people began intensively gathering wheat because they were actually interested in beer.
We'll take a break and we'll come back. We'll talk about these ancient firsts with my guest this hour, science writer Cody Cassidy, Who Ate the First Oyster, the title of his latest book, The Extraordinary People Behind the Greatest Firsts in History. So many to discuss. We won't get to nearly half of them. Who invented clothing? We want to talk about that. Who performed the first surgery? We'll talk about that when we come back with Cody Cassidy. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Science writer Cody Cassidy is with me this hour. Who Ate the First Oyster? The title of his latest book, The Extraordinary People Behind the Greatest Firsts in History. In it, he tells really interesting and a novel way of approaching history. 17 ancient individuals who lived before or without writing. People, according to Cassidy's research, scholars know existed. And he recounts, based on the best scientific evidence we have, who this person must have been, who drank the first beer, who shot the first arrow, who was the first person to, who discovered soap, for instance. I don't know how many we'll get to talk about this hour, but Cody's with us for another half of the program. The one I want to get to, Cody, is, I found this interesting, who invented clothing? And I had never been aware, even though I'm interested in human evolution and so forth, the extent to which there was a period in which our ancestors just did not have clothing, right? And the sort of earlier hominids had a lot of hair, but there was a period in which there were humans who had neither hair nor clothing, right?
That's certainly how it appears, which is shocking. But we lost our body hair when we first controlled fire from Martine, what I was speaking about earlier. But we didn't invent clothing. until around 107,000 years ago, which seems like an exact answer, but remarkably, we can give an exact answer because even though clothing degrades, geneticists have looked at our body lice, and body lice live on clothing. They've evolved from head lice, which are their ancestors, and it turns out around 107,000 years ago, someone who I call Ralph must have put on clothing, and the body lice took notice, and or the head lice, and evolved to live, cling on that clothing, and that's how we can tell when it was invented. But I think the even more interesting is why it was invented, and I think the answer is that it probably didn't have to do with climate. It didn't have to do because Ralph was probably not cold, which. Because humans, he was a modern human, he had been living in where he was in Africa for thousands and thousands of years, as you said, without clothing and without hair. They had no need for warmth. And in fact, there are cultures, hunter-gatherer cultures in Tasmania and in South America who were living in colder climates than he was and didn't use clothing. They used fire for warmth. Mm-hmm. So perhaps a better explanation for why he invented clothing was that all humans decorate their bodies. Every culture we've ever discovered has decorated themselves in some way and in some strange and different ways, everything from the tattoos to neckties. So I think the best answer, I called him Ralph because I was naming him after Ralph Lauren, because he was interested in fashion rather than function when he donned his first pair of clothes, I believe.
It's fashion, not function, that probably determined the first bit of clothing. Do we know which article of clothing was invented first, or any guesses on that?
A
cloak or something, maybe, huh?
We are remarkably inventive when it comes to clothing. I think you can only, when it comes to neckties and bow ties and foot binding, there are all sorts of imaginative ways that humans have clothe themselves decoratively. So I think it's nearly impossible to say what he actually did or wore, but I do think it's clothing did not evolve to be fashionable. It began that way.
Okay. Let's talk Cody Cassidy, my guest this hour. His book, Who Ate the First Oyster? Extraordinary People Behind the Greatest Firsts in History. I found this other one, this invention, which was pivotal for humankind to be fascinating, your account of it in discussions, quotes from experts here. Who shot the first arrow? So when we say, and you say, if the time of our species on Earth were a day, this happened at 6:48 in the evening, or translated 64,000 years ago. And you name this individual Shanidar III, the oldest victim of a bow and arrow that archaeologists have ever discovered. This is in the mountains, what is now northeastern Iraq. And this involves a Neanderthal. And what I didn't realize is, what you point out here is that so many of the inventions that humans made were done by observing nature, the wheel, for instance. But with the arrow and the bow, we have what? The first invention that has no replicate. It is not mimicking nature.
Yeah, it's unique, which means it was probably like most entirely unique inventions stumbled upon by accident. And Shanidar III is the first victim of the bow and arrow. He was a Neanderthal, probably shot by a Homo sapien. But the weapon that killed this Neanderthal was a sophisticated weapon. It launched an arrow at high speed, and that's not generally how inventions begin. They're usually clunky, which means the inventor, who I call Archie, and he lived around 64,000 years ago. This was where the oldest arrowheads have been found, they've been found in South Africa. Was probably playing around with sticks and strings and beads, which were common to this culture, and sort of tied them together and sort of enjoyed the launching small sticks. But that, of course, is not a killer weapon, and it's a toy, which that seems like a surprising transition to go from a toy to probably the most effective weapon in human history. But it's actually really common. The boomerang began as a toy, so did gunpowder, rockets. So then I think it developed. It took maybe hundreds or thousands of years of playing with it as a toy before people were able to increase the power to kill a Neanderthal. So I think the inventor and the first people who shot arrows were probably children.
I wonder, before we go on to the next story, Cody, what did you find the biggest challenge in doing this? You had the initial idea some years ago, I assume. And then, I mean, the real appeal of this book to me is that you approached it for trying to make these people real. And in every case, in some way, you take this person, this figure, and try to sort of stand them next to us in a setting, in the room, and say, what would they be like? And I think that's really inventive, and it really sort of pops these, what could be just really kind of boring historical figures, pops them out of the page and brings them into the reader's room, into their presence.
Yeah, that was, I really wanted to personalize these people, because I think we often, this stuff happened so long ago that we sort of, it all sort of blends together. But real people lived so long ago, and they made incredible discoveries. So I wanted to make them feel alive and tell their story as accurate as I could. So that's why I tried to bring in as many personal details of them as possible, mm-hmm. for sure.
Let's talk. Have you tell us a little bit about the who performed the first surgery? So relatively close in terms of human history to our time, just 7,000 years ago, and you explain it has to do with a procedure called trepanation. None of us would want to have that procedure performed on us. But explain, what is trepanation, and how does it appear in archaeological history?
Yeah, we certainly wouldn't. The most shocking thing about the first surgery is the procedure itself. It's not a simple one, or it's not a seemingly simple one. It's archaeologists found these are 7,000-year-old skulls in eastern France that have two concentric holes drilled through their skull. At first, of course, they thought this was some sort of funeral practice or sacrifice, but when they looked closer, they discovered that there was quite a bit of healing on these wounds. In other words, these patients survived. And then the even more shocking thing, this is sort of the first surgeon I called Dr. Zero. He was actually trying to help these patients, and he may have. It's 'cause this procedure is actually performed modernly, not quite in the same way, but it's called a craniotomy. And they believe that he was, there was quite a lot of war at this time, and there were a lot of head injuries. And if you're cracked in the skull, but you can get some internal bleeding, and it's quite awful symptoms, confusion and paralysis. But if he had shaved, if he was probably an experienced surgeon cleaning these wounds, and if he had cut through the scalp with an obsidian blade, there had been a little bit of bleeding, but not too much, and then he probably shaved through the skull, which sounds horrifying, but it's actually there are no nerves there, so he wouldn't have needed to anesthetize. And if he didn't go through the membrane that protects the brain, it would probably not have resulted in infection, and he would have actually helped these poor ancient patients by allowing the blood to flow freely.
Right, right. And as incredibly as it sounds, these would have been, there is archaeological evidence that these prehistoric patients lived long after their surgeries.
Yeah, in many cases they lived years. And another, this wasn't the only place that this procedure was performed. It's found all over the world, in Peru and in Asia. So it seems to have been independently discovered repeatedly. Of course, it was also overprescribed. There are a few numerous examples of patients who we can see from the bone had different types of ailments, infections and such, and so that when the surgeons did this, they probably actually made it significantly worse. But at least in a few cases, we think that they helped quite a bit.
Okay. Science writer Cody Cassidy, we have about 10 minutes to spend with Cody. His latest book, Who Ate the First Oyster? The Extraordinary People Behind the Greatest Firsts in History. He looks at 17 ancient individuals, recreates what it must have been like in their time, made them the discoverers of these ancient firsts based on what his interviews with scholars, his interviews, his reading of many books and going through many research papers. I like the story of who rode the first horse because it gets to a lot of different aspects that that I've read about before in terms of the domestication of certain animals. Jared Diamond, you quote him, why certain animals, what they need to become domesticated, why we don't have, you know, panthers are not domesticated, for instance, and then what it must have taken to ride the first horse approximately 5,600 years ago. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so horses were domesticated a little bit before then, but they were only used as meat. And so the first people to ride them might have been right after domestication, and they were probably doing so as a kind of stunt. But really, the first person to truly ride a horse was the person who invented the bridle. And archaeologists can see these markings on horse teeth. The first markings on horse teeth from a bridle are around 5,600 years ago. And it was invented by someone who I've named Napoleon. He was a member of the Botai culture in northern Kazakhstan. And these were a horse-obsessed people. They drank their milk, they ate them, and then after his invention, they rode horses to hunt other horses. And I think he must have invented it because he was a horse obsessive amongst horse obsessives, and he realized there was this gap in the horse's mouth that allowed a strap to go. And once he had this strap, you can control your horse, and he had brakes basically on this fast animal. And sort of by inventing brakes, he invented speed. He became the first person to travel over land faster than his own 2 feet could carry him, which is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, and you spin out, if in case it's not obvious, what implications this has for people who master the horse, who master riding horses. This speed, it increases the speed of, well, attacking tribes, attacking armies, by great, and they can overwhelm another force very easily, or surprise another force very easily, as the humans had never before been able to do.
Yeah, they can see, archaeologists see these defensive structures spring up right after the bridle was invented, and so it was probably the horse was the first getaway vehicle. Basically, the dangerous part of a raid is not the actual raid generally, but it was getting away. If you're getting away on your own 2 feet, you can be hunted down. But the horse tipped the balance in favor of the raider, because they could raid the other person's encampment, probably steal their horses, and run away and get away with it. So, it probably had some violent, unintended consequences, certainly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Let's go to a very common invention. We don't think of it as an invention, but it sure was at one time. And for our day and age, which is talked about incessantly in our news, who discovered soap? You write, no medical product and perhaps no medical discovery has saved more human life than soap. So this is about 4,500 years ago. First of all, it's interesting to note that even though soap is part of our daily lives, most people, back me up on this, Cody, if you ask people on the street, what is soap anyway, it would be not answerable by a lot of people.
Yeah, soap does two things. It basically allows you to it allows you to clean off grease. You know, when grease, and you can't clean grease with just water. And soap saponification allows the chemicals to, it basically allows oil to coexist with water, so it can remove it from your skin and wash it away. But it also destroys viruses and bacteria, as we've heard so much now. But this is, and it has saved more lives than penicillin, probably. But it has been sort of serially underrated, and that is true for even the invention of it.
Mm-hmm. And you create the discoverer of the soap recipe. You call her Nini, after a Sumerian goddess of medicine. How did you create her, and what would be that moment when she found the key to making soap?
So yes, this was around 4,500 years ago. She was an Akkadian, and she was. They had these large textile factories, which is remarkable for how long ago this was. But they were producing a lot of wool in Mesopotamia at the time, and she invented soap. We can see from a tablet a basic recipe for soap, probably to remove lanolin from wool, which is a fat that surrounds wool, and you can't really spin wool until you remove it. And so she invented soap, which is it's really a simple process. It's really just fat and lye, which is like you can find from the ash of a fire. And she probably made it to just slightly improve a manufacturing process and had no understanding of its power for human health. And in fact, it's sort of been 4,500 years of us really understanding how great of an invention she made.
Yeah, so pre-soap history would have been what? Just filled with a lot of disease, and we were just dirtier individuals.
Certainly. I mean, it wasn't until the 1800s that even doctors were washing their hands in between procedures. So it has been quite a bit of time for humans to understand quite how effective soap is at saving life.
Mm-hmm. We've almost come to the end of our hour, Cody. This is such a fascinating book, an enjoyable read. Who Ate the First Oyster? I wanted to have you briefly comment on your previous book that you co-authored with Paul Doherty, and then You're Dead, What Really Happens If You Get Swallowed by a Whale, are shot from a cannon, or go barreling over Niagara. That came out in what year?
That came out three years ago.
Mm-hmm. 3 years. Right, and so this may be new to some people. I remember it coming out as well. So what were you answered just really crazy questions and explored them in a scientific way. Share one of your favorite questions that you explored in that book.
We looked into what would happen if the cable on your elevator broke, this is an old fear of mine, and determined that because I've always thought that if you jumped, you know, right before it hit, you could survive if you could just somehow time it correctly. But this is not the case, unfortunately. You would reach if you fell from a skyscraper, it would reach terminal velocity. And smash into the ground, and it sort of doesn't matter whether you jump or not. You're still gonna hit the ground at nearly 200 miles an hour. But what you should really do is actually lie flat. If you lie flat on your back on the elevator, you can actually spread out the deceleration. You might live. This has actually happened before. There was a plane crash in the Empire State Building in the early 1900s, and the elevator operator survived. So it's not impossible if you orient yourself correctly.
Okay, we've run out of time. Science writer Cody Cassidy, thank you so much for sharing your new book, Who Ate the First Oyster? The Extraordinary People Behind the Greatest Firsts in History, an account of 17 ancient individuals, people who, according to Cassidy's research, and he did a lot of it for this book, scholars know they existed. Cody, thank you very much for being with us this hour, we appreciate your time. Fascinating read. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
River to River is produced by Rick Brewer, Caitlin Harrop, and Matt Alvarez. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. If you'd like to find a podcast of this program or any of our other previous programs, simply go to iowapublicradio.org. Look for River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.